Israel strikes back at Iran.
But these strikes appear to be quite limited and calibrated, not so much to cause any damage or loss of life, but to demonstrate to the Iranian government that Israel has the power to strike inside the country.
Plus, the U.S. blocks full Palestinian membership in the U.N.
The Palestinian ambassador was saying, we just want to be your equals. We want to enter your club as your equals. We're not trying to deny any other state. In other words, Israel, we're just trying to say we're a state too. We want to be your equals.
And later, an update from Kyiv and a look at the rise of anti-Semitism in the United States. Today is Friday, April 19th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Israel launched an attack Friday on Iranian soil. It's the latest in a tit-for-tat exchange between the two countries, whose decades of shadow war has broken out into the open and threatens to drag the entire region into deeper conflict. Israel has said for days it was planning to retaliate against Iran for the hundreds of missiles and drones Tehran launched towards Israel this past weekend. The attack on Iran was centered near the city of Isfahan, and authorities from the IAEA say a nuclear facility nearby is undamaged. For more details, I'm joined by Shane Harris. He's a national security and intelligence writer for The Washington Post.
So last night, Israel launched a number of airstrikes against targets in Iran. We think that there was one that was aimed at the central province of Isfahan, which is home to at least one Iranian nuclear development facility. But these strikes appear to be quite limited and calibrated, not so much to cause any damage or loss of life, but to demonstrate to the Iranian government that Israel has the power to strike inside the country when it wants. So more to send a message, it looks like, than to try and damage any infrastructure or kill any Iranian personnel.
One of the things that was so astounding about the Iranian attack on Israel was its sheer size, hundreds of missiles and drones. Was the Israeli response anywhere near that size?
In volume, it appears not to be. We're still not entirely clear on how many drones or missiles Israel may have launched. The Iranian side has talked about having shot down three drones, and there are some reports about explosions in the area of these strikes. But from everything we're picking up, it does not look like the volume of munitions that Israel threw at Iran last night was anything close in quantity to what Iran fired at Israel.
Now, following the Iranian attack on Israel, there were some analysts, including on this show, who said that, look, Iran had been telegraphing this response for a while. They launched their slower drones first. They alerted their neighbors. They alerted countries in the area this was coming. It was sort of a way to have a large attack against Israel, yet still give Israel and allies time to shoot those missiles and drones down to avoid any real damage. Take that with what you just said about the Israeli response, again, that it was meant to prove a point more than do any damage. Now that everybody's made their point, is this the end of it?
I think that's the hope, certainly. Any analysts that we've been talking to in the past several hours think that there's pretty compelling evidence that that may be the case. I mean, if Israel had wanted to cause much more damage, they could have done that. They have the capacity to do it. They have weapons of sufficient strength. They did not do that. It's also the case that, you know, even if Iran was hoping in its earlier strike on Israel to cause more damage, and it didn't because some of the missiles failed or they were shot down so successfully by the U.S. and Israel and others, that the end result of that was that no one in Israel died. So it kind of had teed up, I think a lot of people expected, a response from Israel that might be more limited. And now that we've seen that limited response, I think that's what leads many to the conclusion that this may be the end of it. It could have gone a different way. If the Iranian attack had resulted in large death of civilians, I doubt that the Israeli response would have been as measured as it appears to be.
Well, along those lines, there are still those in Israel, even after the reality of what the Iranian strike was, there are still those in Israel who were calling for a massive Israeli response, for a much bigger one than we saw. What's the political situation like in Israel now? How are the Israeli hardliners reacting to what happened?
Some of the initial responses from, you know, a few hardliners that we saw last night as this was happening was indicated they felt that this was not a strong enough strike by Israel. So I would expect that today we'll continue hearing some of those calls from hardliners. It's also the case that, you know, hardline elements of the coalition there in Israel have been pushing for broader attacks, including on Hezbollah, which is the Iranian-backed militia in Lebanon. And the government has not done that. So consistently, it has been kind of Netanyahu resisting some of these calls of hardliners. And the U.S. has stepped in to try and to stop that from happening as well. But I think that, like, now when we're seeing that Israel clearly demonstrated that it has the ability to do this, that may give Netanyahu a little bit more room to maneuver too. Certainly, the United States wants him not to listen to hardline elements of his government and start a war with Iran. But honestly, we just have to wait and see. I mean, the situation for months has been so combustible in the region. And while it looks like everything is kind of settling down, you know, wait a few weeks. It might change, I guess, is what I'm saying.
We'll leave it here for today. Shane Harris writes about national security for The Washington Post. Shane, thanks for being with us again.
Great to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
Reaction inside Israel is mixed. Many Israelis are conflicted, feeling justified in striking back against Iran, but also not wanting the war against Hamas to grow. Moshe Pretz lives in Tel Aviv.
Israel attacked United Iran land because we were supposed to. We have no other option besides to react. But this is not the way we want it to be. We want to get back to our routine, our life, to run, to live our life. No more war. It's enough.
Another Israeli, Uzi Evron, is of the opinion that only strong military force can bring about peace with Israel's neighbors.
I think the attack in Iran is a necessary action in our environment, which is much harsher than the jungle in Africa. Animals over there behave much nicer than human in this area. I think the action was mild, which will cause Iran to stop hostility for now, although the threat will remain in the area until much harsher action will be taken to root evil out of this region.
While at the same time, there are those who see the retaliation as an invitation to yet even more violence.
I'm very sad that Israel attacked Iran, and I'm afraid what will happen now. What will be in Israel?
That was Edna Rashef out on the streets of Tel Aviv on Friday. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, along with many other diplomats and world leaders, had been urging Israel to show restraint in its response. Blinken is in Italy for a G7 conference. He says that his goal is still de-escalation.
The United States has not been involved in any offensive operations. What we're focused on, what the G7 is focused on, and again, it's reflected in our statement and in our conversation, is our work to de-escalate tensions, to de-escalate from any potential conflict. You saw Israel on the receiving end of an unprecedented attack, but our focus has been on, of course, making sure that Israel can effectively defend itself, but also de-escalating tensions, avoiding conflict, and that remains our focus.
So far, Israel has said nothing about the incident, though it had been saying for days it was planning to retaliate. Thursday evening in New York, the United States effectively stopped the UN from recognizing a Palestinian state by casting a veto in the Security Council to deny the Palestinian Authority full membership of the United Nations.
The result of the vote is as follows: 12 votes in favor, 1 vote against, 2 abstentions. The draft resolution has not been adopted owing to the negative vote of a permanent member of the Council.
The United States says an independent Palestinian state should be established through direct negotiations between Israel and the Palestinian Authority, and not through UN action.
The United States voted no on this Security Council resolution. Again, the United States continues to strongly support a two-state solution. This vote does not reflect opposition to Palestinian statehood, but instead is an acknowledgement that it will only come from direct negotiations between the parties.
That's Robert Wood, the U.S. representative to the UN. The Palestinians are currently a non-member observer state. An application to become a full member of the UN needs to be approved by the Security Council and then at least two-thirds of the General Assembly. For a deeper dive, I'm joined by VOA's UN correspondent, Margaret Bashir.
So I think it was an important vote on Thursday at the United Nations Security Council. Palestine wanted to get full UN membership, which in essence means statehood, because only states are full UN members. So they were looking to upgrade their status from non-member state to state. And the U.S. was not happy about it. They have stuck to their line for many decades that the best way for statehood for the Palestinian people is through direct negotiations between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. And they consider this a final status issue. But the argument the Palestinians make is that it's been 70 years and they still don't have a state, you know, so they're frustrated. And I think although the United States blocked it and it failed, in some ways there was a bit of a symbolic win for the Palestinians in that 12 of the 15 council members supported this bit of theirs. I think it showed that they had strong support in the council. And if it had been adopted in the council, then the next step would have been to go to the General Assembly. And the General Assembly is the real state maker because they are the final stop. And the 193 member states, no vetoes there. They just need a two-thirds majority. And it's pretty clear they would have it there because there are a lot of countries that already recognize them. There are about 140 countries that recognize a state of Palestine. So they wouldn't have trouble there. But you can't go to the General Assembly unless you can make it through the Security Council. And they did not. But the Algerians, who are representing the Arabs in the council and who brought this resolution, they said they will be back. So we, you know, stay tuned.
So had the vote succeeded, had the measure passed and it had gone on to be approved by the General Assembly, what would that mean for Palestinian statehood? They don't have land that is agreed upon as theirs in a technical way. How could they have a state? How could they have a seat in the UN?
Well, they already have a seat. They just can't vote. But they can, for instance, join international bodies like the International Criminal Court and the World Health Organization, UNESCO, groups like this. So if they got full membership, then they would have a vote in the General Assembly. They could even theoretically run for a seat on the Security Council if they wanted to. So it would certainly give them privileges that they don't have now, but it would also give them a big moral boost, you know, morale boost, I should say, really, a morale boost to go back to their people to say the world recognizes us as a state.
Now, I know that Israel is not on the Security Council now, but did you see any reaction from the Israeli delegation to the UN? What did they have to say?
Yes, Ambassador Gilad Erdan attended the meeting that went on all day yesterday. And he said that if the council approved Palestinian membership, then basically they're rewarding Hamas terrorists and they're rewarding a terror state. And he said that the Security Council should therefore be called the Terror Council if they did it. He was quite, he had his hackles up about it. And the Russian ambassador wasn't having anything of it. And he said to him, I'll remind you that Israel was created by a General Assembly resolution. And, you know, so don't give us a hard time. So there was a bit of back and forth in the council on Thursday. In fact, I saw the Maltese ambassador brush away a tear from her eye at one point when the Palestinian ambassador was saying, we just want to be your equals. We want to enter your club as your equals. You know, we're not trying to deny any other state. In other words, Israel, we're just trying to say we're a state too. We want to be your equals.
So what happens next?
well, we'll just wait and see. The Algerians said we'll be back. So I don't know if they'll be back soon or if they'll wait to see what happens in the U.S. elections in November to see if there might be a different administration. Although I don't think a Trump administration would be any more sympathetic to the Palestinians based on past experience. So I think it's a little up in the air. We'll just have to wait and see.
We're going to leave it there for today. Margaret Bashir is VOA's correspondent at the United Nations in New York. Margaret, thanks for your reporting. Thanks for your analysis on this.
Sure, Steve.
You're listening to Flashpoint, Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. A disturbing trend in the United States. Incidents of anti-Semitism are on the rise. We'll learn more in a few minutes. Now, though, to Ukraine, where Russian forces have conducted another massive missile and drone attack, killing at least 8 people. Meanwhile, President Volodymyr Zelensky is visiting one of the hottest areas along the front lines. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the details from Kyiv.
Before dawn on April 19, Russian forces launched a combined missile and drone attack across Ukraine. Ukrainian air defense reported the destruction of 15 of 22 missiles of various types and 14 drones. As a result of the attack, 2 people were killed and 15 injured in the central part of the city of Dnipro. Elsewhere in the Dnipropetrovsk region, 6 people were killed, including 6 and 8-year-old children, and 2 injured, the Ministry of Internal Affairs reported. The rescue operation is underway. Also, a critical infrastructure facility was damaged, including 3 people. Also, early on Friday, the governor of the Stavropol region in Russia reported a crash of a Tu-22 jet, which was used by Russian forces to conduct missile attacks on Ukraine. According to preliminary information, 2 pilots survived. Russian local authorities did not provide any additional details, but published a photo of the crashed plane. Russian telegram channels reported that the Tu-22 jet was shot down. Later, it was confirmed by Kyiv that Ukrainian defense forces shot down the Russian plane, a long-range strategic bomber, for the first time. Meanwhile, President Zelensky is visiting the Donetsk region on April 19. Zelensky met with wounded Ukrainian soldiers who are undergoing rehabilitation treatment and awarded them with state awards. He also visited one of the common posts of one of the brigades defending Chasiv Yar, one of the hottest spots at Russia-Ukraine war at the moment. Zelensky addressed the troops.
Приємно бути тут, побачити вас особисто і подякувати, нагородити особисто вас.
It is a pleasure to be here, to see you in person, and to thank you and reward you in person. You are in one of the hottest, or maybe the hottest, direction of the battles for our state today. Thank you for fighting for Ukraine, for Donbas. I am grateful to those of you who, unfortunately, are no longer with us, but they are always in our memory. I wish you health, strength, and victory.
Zelensky held a meeting with the military to discuss the security situation in the region and the actions to be taken to protect civilians. He also inspected the construction of the fortifications along the front line. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
Back in Washington, as lawmakers in Congress edge closer to Saturday's expected vote on a $61 billion security assistance package for Ukraine, a top U.S. intelligence official warned that help cannot come fast enough. VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Selden has the story.
CIA Director William Burns calls the situation dire and says Ukraine's fate may well hinge on what U.S. lawmakers do next.
There is a very real risk that the Ukrainians could lose on the battlefield by the end of 2024.
Speaking to an audience in Dallas, Burns described the U.S. supplemental assistance package as more than a lifeline for Kyiv in its war against Russia and Russian President Vladimir Putin, if Congress passes it soon.
The Ukrainians are entirely capable of holding their own through 2024 and puncturing Putin's arrogant view that time is on his side.
The CIA director says the U.S. aid will allow Ukraine to strike deeper into Crimea and do more damage to Russia's Black Sea Fleet, where Ukrainian forces have sunk 16 Russian warships in just the last 6 months. Meanwhile, at the Pentagon, officials say they're confident they can get Ukraine the aid it needs if lawmakers approve the $61 billion package.
We have a very robust logistics network that enables us to move materiel very quickly.
Pentagon Press Secretary Major General Pat Ryder.
The Ukrainians have demonstrated their resilience and their courage under fire. We have no reason to think that that's going to change, but we also understand the dire situation there right now, which is why, again, we would like very much to see the supplemental passed.
Should U.S. lawmakers approve the additional assistance for Ukraine, the Pentagon says the first deliveries could include air defense and artillery capabilities. Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
And finally, today, the number of anti-Semitic incidents in the U.S. hit a record high last year as anti-Jewish sentiment spiked after the start of the Israel-Hamas war. That, according to a report released this week by the Jewish advocacy group, the Anti-Defamation League. VOA's Lori London spoke with Rachel Sass, anti-Semitic incident specialist with the ADL's Center on Extremism.
The ADL has been tracking increases in anti-Semitic incidents for the past few years. We broke records in 2022, 2021, and even in the early months of 2023, we were tracking increases. But the major factor in the not just increase, but skyrocketing of incidents was the post-October 7th moment. So the October 7th massacre in Israel by Hamas, and then the war that resulted from that. After October 7th, we recorded over 5,000 incidents just in the months of October, November, and December. And this is more than in any other year prior, much more than any other year prior.
So it sounds like these incidents have been on the rise every year, but this really escalated it.
Exactly.
Was this across the country in every state? And also, of course, we've been hearing a lot about incidents on college campuses as well.
Yes. So we tracked incidents in all 50 states and in the District of Columbia. The states with the highest number of incidents were California, New York, New Jersey. These are states with large populations in general, and especially with large Jewish populations. And that tracks with trends that we've seen in the past. And yeah, the trend on college campuses is really concerning. As much as the number of anti-Semitic incidents spiked in general, the rise was even more precipitous on college campuses. We tracked over 900 incidents on college campuses. And this marked over 300% increase over the year prior.
Would you say these findings are a part of a bigger global trend beyond the U.S.?
Yes. So in other countries, there are some organizations that ADL partners with that have also tracked really concerning rises in anti-Semitism. And I think that this does track with a global trend of rising anti-Semitism.
And there have also been reported discrimination and attacks against Muslims and Palestinians reaching record highs in 2023, according to the Council on American Islamic Relations. What does that say about this overall trend as well?
At the ADL, we've definitely noted hate incidents of targeting a large number of minority groups. And I think it's true that conflicts in other countries, so for example, the conflict between Israel and Hamas right now, people who are perceived to have an association with that are often targeted. And unfairly, Jews should not be targeted for the actions of the Israeli government. Arabs, Palestinians, Muslims should not be targeted for the actions of any other Hamas or any other group. But I do think that ADL's report here shows a particularly concerning trend in anti-Semitism. And we really think that it will take a whole society approach to tackle this problem.
Lori London hosts Issues in the News here on VOA. She was speaking with Rachel Sass of the Anti-Defamation League. And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next week, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.